Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive.
Today we're taking on a concept, a word really, that is maybe one of the most misused terms in business and politics and, well, military life.
You mean strategy?
Exactly. Everyone talks about having a strategy, but when you really look closer, they're usually just talking about a plan.
Or worse, just a list of tactics.
So to fix that, we are diving into Antulio J. Echevarria the Sexton's incredible book, Military Strategy. A very short introduction.
That's right. Our mission today is pretty focused. We're trying to solve what Echevarria himself calls strategic illiteracy.
And what's the core of that illiteracy?
It's that strategy is not just planning. I mean, planning is what you do before the first shot is fired, right? Before the negotiation even starts. Strategy is what you do after your opponent makes their move.
And that's where most people get it wrong.
And even though our source material is all about military power, this matters so much to you, the listener, no matter what you do. Strategy is really that foundational bridge that connects your biggest goals.
Your career goals, your political goals.
To the actual day-to-day actions you take and the resources you have. Understanding that connection is, I think, a universal framework for success in any competitive environment.
So who's our guide on this journey? Antulio J. Echevarria II is, well, he's the ideal person to write this book.
Why is that?
Because he brings together two worlds. He's a retired U.S. Army lieutenant colonel, so he knows what it's like to execute plans under fire. But he also has a PhD in history from Princeton.
Ah, so he's the practitioner scholar. That's the perfect combination.
Exactly.
He hasn't just, you know, read about history. He's lived the reality of command, where all that clean theory meets mud and friction and, well, reality.
Right. His work has that rigorous analysis you'd expect from a top historian, but it's infused with these really pragmatic insights from a soldier who knows that a perfect plan is pretty much worthless if it can't be executed.
And he also taught at the U.S. Army War College for a long time, right?
A very long time. He was even the editor-in-chief of its journal, Parameters, which is hugely influential. He is absolutely at the center of how people think and debate strategy today. He taught the people who are actually implementing this stuff globally.
Which gives his writing so much authority. I mean, when he explains why a really sophisticated plan might just collapse, it's not just theory. It's knowledge from watching it unfold in the real world.
And that leads us right into the book's central premise. Echevarria just cuts through all the cliches. He argues that strategy is not some static blueprint. It's not a checklist for victory.
So what is it?
He defines it as a dynamic and continuous, and I love this phrase, a dialogue of force.
A dialogue? That's a great frame for it.
Isn't it? It immediately grounds the whole idea in reality. It's not a monologue you're giving to the world. It's a high-stakes chess match where both players are constantly making moves and counter moves.
Flexible and responsive.
Exactly. And to give us that strategist's toolkit, he offers a formal definition. Strategy is the intellectual art and science of applying military power to achieve political objectives.
And the core of that definition is the link between the three things, right?
The indispensable link. The political ends, that's your goals. The military ways, the actions you take. And the available means, which are your resources.
Ends, ways, means. That EWM paradigm is basically the engine of the whole book.
It's the framework he applies to everything across thousands of years of history.
Yeah, the book takes us on this incredible journey.
Yeah.
It starts with, you know, the ancient wisdom of Sun Tzu and Thucydides.
Then it moves through the Napoleonic era, which gave us Clausewitz and his, let's say, messy view of war. Then it shows how technology just shattered strategies in the world wars.
And then the whole game changes with the nuclear age.
Right. And finally, we land right here in the 21st century, trying to grapple with non-state actors, hybrid conflict, cyber warfare, the whole complex mess.
But the point is that while the character of war is always changing with technology, the basic logic of balancing those ends, ways, and means, that's timeless.
It is. So let's dive into that core logic. The book really starts with the idea that military action is always subordinate.
Subordinate to what?
To policy. Echevarria really emphasizes this. Policy is what dictates the what and the why, you know, the ultimate ends. Strategy is just about the how. the ways and the means.
And that's the first mistake people make, isn't it? Policy is deciding you want to, say, secure more market share. The strategy is figuring out how you do that. Mm. Aggressive pricing, product innovation, and alliance.
Exactly. The strategy has to serve the policy, always. And the acid test for any strategy is that ends, ways, means paradigm. If those three things are in balance, the strategy is fundamentally broken.
So if your goals, your ends, are way too ambitious for the resources your means you have,
the whole thing fails. It doesn't matter how well you execute.
Can you give us a quick analogy for that in the real world?
Oh, sure. Think of a business. Your end is to achieve 50% market dominance in 5 years. Your ways are aggressive pricing and scaling up fast.
Sounds ambitious.
It is. But your means, your available cash and your supply chain, can only handle 20% growth. You have a massive strategic imbalance. You'll run out of money or product, and the whole strategy just collapses under its own weight.
That clarity is so useful. Okay, so applying that framework backwards in time to the ancient masters, Echevarria brings up Sun Tzu.
Of course. And the key takeaway from Sun Tzu is that the ultimate skill is to subdue the enemy without fighting.
The ultimate strategic efficiency.
It's the definition of the indirect approach. Don't attack their armies, attack their plans. Use deception, use intelligence, and maneuver your opponent into a position where they look at the board and just conclude they can't win, so they back down.
So a corporate version of that is winning a price war. It's maybe buying the key patent that makes your competitor's entire product line obsolete overnight.
Exactly. Market dominance without a single messy battle for customers. It's all about position and perception.
Then you've got Thucydides, who gives us the human dimension. He analyzed the Peloponnesian War as this political drama driven by, what were they?
The three unchanging human motivators,
mm-hmm.
fear, honor, and interest. His point was that strategy is always human, always political. It's driven by passion as much as by rational math.
Which brings us to the modern era and the big split between Jomini and Clausewitz.
The famous contrast. Jomini was the Enlightenment guy. He wanted to make war a predictable science. He was looking for timeless geometric principles, almost like a military algorithm for victory.
And Clausewitz.
Well, Clausewitz is the one Echevarria clearly favors because he was a realist. He saw war as inherently messy, unpredictable, and deeply political.
His famous line.
War is nothing but the continuation of policy by other means. It's a constant reminder that victory isn't the goal. The political objective is the goal.
So if Jomini was looking for clear rules, and Clausewitz saw mostly chaos, how do we square that?
Clausewitz did it with his wondrous trinity. He said war is a constant interaction between three forces. Passion, which is the people. Chance, which is the military and its commander. And reason, which is the government's policy.
And those three things are always pulling on each other.
Constantly. It makes war non-linear. A passionate public might demand an action that reason knows is a bad idea. And your strategy has to be flexible enough to handle that.
You know, that wondrous trinity is so relevant today. Just think about how social media amplifies the passion part, forcing the reason part, the government, to react way faster and maybe less strategically.
It completely changes the landscape, and that leads to the biggest non-human obstacle in strategy, friction.
This concept is huge.
Echevarria stresses it. Friction is the idea that everything in war is simple, but the simplest thing is difficult. It's all the little things that go wrong. Bad weather, misunderstandings, fatigue, chance errors.
I think this is the most valuable concept for anyone listening.
Yeah.
If you're launching a big project at work, friction isn't the one massive bug that crashes everything.
No.
It's the missing cable, the email sent to the wrong person, the three team members who get sick, the server that needs an update. It's the drag.
Precisely. And the ultimate case study of friction causing failure is the Schlieffen Plan in World War I, a massive, rigid, timetabled strategy to win in 6 weeks. It failed almost immediately.
Because it was totally inflexible. It couldn't handle friction or the enemy's reaction.
It proved a perfect blueprint is useless against reality.
Mm.
Strategic rigidity just invites failure.
And that failure was made even worse by new technologies like the machine gun, which just overwhelmed old offensive strategies and led to total stalemate. Tactical victories meant nothing.
And that stalemate set the stage for the nuclear age, where the whole objective of strategy changed.
How so?
Well, when the weapons became too powerful to actually use, strategy shifted from trying to win wars to trying to prevent them.
That's the diplomacy of violence idea, right? We move from physical strategy to psychological strategy.
Exactly right. You get concepts like deterrence, the threat of unacceptable retaliation, you know, mutually assured destruction, MAD.
And compellence.
And compellence, which is about coercing an adversary to do something. Thinkers like Thomas Schelling use game theory for this, focusing on risk and communication, which gave us brinkmanship.
Okay. Give us a simple way to distinguish deterrence from compellence. They sound a bit similar.
Deterrence is passive. It maintains the status quo. Think of a parent saying, don't break your curfew or you're grounded. That's deterrence.
Right.
Compellence is active. It forces a change in behavior. That's the parent saying, you need to finish your homework right now or I'm taking your phone.
Ah, okay. One is about preventing an action. The other is about forcing one. It's very clear.
Right. And today we see both of these ideas interacting with modern threats like asymmetric warfare.
That's when you have non-state actors like insurgents or terrorist groups who don't fight you head on.
They don't try to defeat your army. They try to erode your political will. They target your domestic support until you just give up.
And that leads to the biggest contemporary challenge of all, which is hybrid warfare.
Which is not just one tactic. It's a synchronized attack across, well, every domain. It blends conventional force, cyber attacks, irregular tactics, and massive disinformation campaigns all at once.
So if asymmetric warfare is about attacking the public's will to fight,
hybrid warfare is attacking the entire system. Imagine a business rival launching cyber attacks on your supply chain, running a smear campaign on social media, and using shell companies to buy up your raw materials all at the same time.
That would require a completely new strategic playbook.
It absolutely does. The sources are clear that strategy now has to deal with threats everywhere, from space down to cyberspace.
Wow. Okay, so given this huge historical sweep and all these deep concepts, what are the, like, three big non-negotiables?
Yeah.
If a listener remembers nothing else from this deep dive, what should it be?
The first and the most important theme is the one we started with. Strategy is subordinate to policy.
Your actions must serve a clear political objective.
Always. If you don't know the why, the how is meaningless. If your managers or your generals are the ones dictating the objective, failure is pretty much baked into the recipe.
That's a great check for personal goal setting, too. Are the tasks you're doing every day actually aligned with your main goal, your policy? Is the daily grind actually serving the major end?
Great point. Okay, theme number two is that strategy is a dialogue, not a monologue. It is not a fixed script. Every single move you make prompts a counter move.
So you need constant intelligence, flexibility, adaptation.
You have to. If you fail to account for that thinking adversary, your competitor, your negotiating partner, you're just talking to yourself. You have to build resilience into the plan. Assume you're going to get counterpunched.
And have a plan B, C, and D ready to go.
Exactly. And the third theme, which ties it all together, the danger of tactical myopia.
Meaning?
Meaning that tactical success, winning a single battle, finishing one project ahead of schedule, is completely meaningless if it doesn't achieve the overall political goal. If you win every single skirmish but still lose the war, Echevarria calls that an expensive failure.
That is a powerful question for any leader to ask. Am I celebrating busyness? Or am I celebrating actual strategic achievement? Are my small victories actually moving the larger needle?
Or are you just getting really good at tasks that have no strategic coherence?
You know, the book is just filled with these powerful distilled ideas that really stick with you.
Mm.
Let's talk about a few of the key quotes or ideas.
Okay, the first one really captures the author's whole approach. He says, "The logic of strategy, the balancing of ends, ways, and means is timeless. However, the character of war is in constant flux, driven by technological, social, and political change."
So that's why we can still learn from Sun Tzu. The weapons change, but the strategic math, that EWM balance, it never does.
Here's another one that hammers home the importance of politics. Strategy is not a substitute for sound policy, nor can it overcome the deficiencies of poor policy.
In other words, you can't execute your way out of a bad idea.
You can't. And finally, the one that serves as the ultimate caution. Tactical success without strategic coherence is merely expensive failure.
You should probably just write that one down and stick it on your mirror.
It's so good. And the real beauty of this whole framework is how easily it jumps from the battlefield into, well, daily life. Take business and corporate strategy.
You could apply ends, ways, means to any big decision.
Absolutely. Let's say your end is 20% growth. Your ways are through mergers and acquisitions. Your means are your available cash and the capacity of your HR team to integrate all these new people.
Right, and if you start five complex mergers, your ways, but your leadership team is already totally burned out. Your means, the strategy is doomed from the start.
The EWM framework just forces that alignment between your ambition and your reality.
And it works for personal development, too. You could define your end, say, pivoting to a new career field.
Your ways would be getting certifications, networking, finding a mentor.
Then you have to be brutally honest about your means, your time, your energy, your financial resources. If you try to get an MBA and two new certifications while working 60 hours a week with a family, your means are just insufficient. The strategy will fail.
It's self-imposed strategic imbalance.
And that's where anticipating friction in your personal life becomes so important. Friction isn't just one big setback like losing your job.
No, it's the cumulative drag.
Yeah.
The paperwork, the unexpected family emergency, the burnout, the fatigue, all the little things that chip away at your ability to execute your plan.
So a good personal strategy has to build in buffers, a strategic reserve of time or energy to absorb that friction without collapsing.
And ultimately, this whole framework changes you from being just a passive consumer of news into an active analyst of international relations.
When you read about a trade dispute or a diplomatic effort, you can immediately apply the EWM test.
For sure. Take a hypothetical trade dispute. What are the political ends they're after? Say, reducing a trade deficit. What are the ways? The specific tariffs. And then the big question, are the means, the political capital, the economic resilience, actually sufficient to achieve that end?
And if you realize the means are way too limited for the stated goal, you can predict with some confidence that the strategy is probably going to fail, no matter how aggressively they pursue it.
It gives you this incredibly rigorous tool for just evaluating the world.
You know, what surprised me most in this deep dive wasn't really the definition of strategy itself. It was the constant reminder that strategy is a creative act. It's the art of creating power-forming alliances,
yeah,
using deception, not just the science of managing the resources you already have.
That's a great point. It elevates it beyond just balancing a budget.
It makes it something much more inventive.
I think so, too. But that creativity always has to be rooted in discipline. For me, the most valuable lesson for you, the listener, is that clarity of thought is the strategist's most important weapon.
Always start with the end in mind.
Always. Always start with the political objective, the ultimate goal, and then work backward from there. A good strategy isn't judged by how elegant it looks on paper. It's judged by its resilience and its flexibility when it slams headfirst into reality, when it meets that infamous friction. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.